Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Mark Sloka, whose most recent book, The Visible World, a novel, has been published by Houghton Mifflin. His earlier books are Lost Lake, which is a book of short stories, and a novel, God's Fool. Now, from the very beginning, Mark Sloka's work has been asking the question, what is a story? And if so, what is history? And if that, what is an anecdote? What is a dream? What is a memory? And this new book, The Visible World, brings together these themes in their most beautiful articulation. It's narrated by a man who was once, as were we all, a young boy, who, following the death of his mother, realizes that what he's known of her has had a mysterious X in the middle, an absence, something that made her moody or sad or evasive, eventually led her to hide in her bedroom. And after her death, he realizes that he will have to stop writing the memoir of his family and his mother and go into life, go to Czechoslovakia, where the family came from. But more than that, he will have to invent a story in order to tell us the thing we so often want to know about our parents. Why did they love each other as much as they did, and why didn't they love each other more? And this is a mystery at the heart of which the narrator's life has been waiting. Now, I thought I'd begin by asking you, the book is divided between a memoir and intermission, intermezzo, and then a novel called 1942.
That's right.
And I wanted to ask why the division. And at what point did you realize that memoir and novel needed to be separated?
Well, I think it's divided, first of all, because I wanted to write about not just the usual kind of stories we tell, but about the fact that almost everything we tell is a form of story. I mean, stories to me are what we tell to know who we are, to make sense of our lives, to shape our lives into something we can live with. And I'm not sure, particularly as I get older, I'm not sure that, you know, the dividing lines between history and story, between, you know, nonfiction and fiction, between anecdote and dream and so on, are quite as hard and fast as some people would believe. Everything is a story on some level. I mean, that, you know, if you recall that night you met, you know, Bobby Joe or someone by the reservoir, you're telling yourself a story. And something you can hopefully live with as you get older.
And again in your work, it's revealed in a story itself that the story is insufficient, that the story is just an incidental shape, and
right.
that an additional fact might lead to a new story.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think there's a I'm sort of obsessed with the notion of silence, you know, the silences in our lives, the gaps, the omissions. And part of that has to do probably with the fact that I was raised as an only child and also as, you know, as the son of immigrants. But I was sort of raised in this, marinated in this culture of silences. And I had to reconcile different versions of stories that were fragments, pieces, much as my narrator is forced to reconcile them. And ultimately, the only thing that was left to me, often since the facts were unavailable or unconvincing, was to tell a story. It's a good way to make a writer, I suppose, or a schizophrenic, maybe. That's good, too.
Toward the beginning of The Visible World, the mother, Ivana, tells the boy a story. And I thought I'd begin by asking Mark Skolka to read a section from The Visible World.
It's my pleasure. This is a section in which the mother is telling her son a story, a tale that she remembers from childhood, from her own childhood. She had been the third child born and the first to survive. There had been a brother who came after her, she told me, though he had lived only a few hours like a moth and had been buried in a down-filled box hardly larger than a loaf of bread. My mother remembered that morning, the morning they buried her little brother, as one of the most precious moments of her childhood. She couldn't tell me why. Sometimes there are things you love and can't explain, she said. A cold morning. A fresh wind roughed the grass along the road. The flowers shook their heads and nodded. Her father, she said, held her hand as they walked, his calloused palm as hard and warm as a piece of wood left in the sun. On the way, she remembered, he told her a wonderful story about a Trpaslik, an elf, who knew the path to a stone door no taller than a hammer that led to the other world, the one below the pond. From there, her father told her, you could look up and see this life, see everything, the trees, the separating clouds, the fishermen pulling at their earlobes or folding up their wooden stools, all this just slightly distorted, like a face behind poorly made glass or a pane of new ice. These glimpses of our world were very precious to those who lived below. They could gaze at a dog's pink tongue lapping at the edge of the sky for hours. And on those rare afternoons when the children leaped from the clouds, spearing down toward the silted roofs of their world clothed in white sheaths of bubbles, they would gather in great swaying crowds, their clothes fluttering about them, and weep. I begged her to tell me what happened after that, how the story ended, but she had forgotten. It didn't matter. There were some things my mother wouldn't tell me. I was used to that. But the story bothered me. I wondered what the pond people did in the winter when the sky above their heads stiffened and their world went dark, how they could see or play, and whether they had great watery fires to keep them warm.
Mark Skolka reading a section from The Visible World. Now, as we read on, that sense of a world underwater or a world buried is going to be central to this book, and the first time we really encounter it is a description of Prague, a city which we discover that has in fact been buried. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting story told. Actually, this is one of those other kinds of stories, the stories that actually have a rooting in fact. Centuries ago, the flooding of the Vltava River, which flooded on a regular basis, became such a problem that the citizens of Prague decided to essentially build up the level of the old town. And over decades and decades, they carted in an unthinkable amount of soil and essentially buried the first story, which of course is a rich metaphor for me, under the earth, raising effectively by 2 meters the level of their town. So even today, when you go into certain basements in Prague, you can find these ghostly windows and doors that look out on gardens that don't exist anymore, that are, you know, a meter and a half under the earth. To me, that's enormously, that's profoundly moving.
And not only that, it suggests what will be true in this book, that the story is buried yeah. under the surface.
Yeah.
In fact, the central event of this book takes place with 8 men, 7 of whom are buried in a crypt. They are hiding out. They've right. been partisans who've murdered a member of the Reichstag. And eventually, when they are found, that crypt is filled with water.
Right.
And they
right.
drown. And so the image of a story under the earth generates the imagery of this novel.
Absolutely. Everything grows out of that central image. The 7 partisans who assassinated Reinhard Heydrich were also kind of buried by history, I suppose, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write about them, to unearth their story. Heydrich was assassinated in May of 1942 by 7 boys, essentially. They were kids. An act of unthinkable heroism, and actually the only case of a high-ranking Nazi official being assassinated during the entirety of the war. they knew what they were doing. They knew what the chances of survival were nil. They chose to do it anyway. And I still find that, I mean, in today's, you know, world, the word hero has been sort of demoted so that anybody who can, you know, throw a three-pointer in at the buzzer is a hero. Anyone who doesn't leave their family is a hero. These men, to me, were still sort of the pure, unadulterated thing. And when I lived in Prague, I lived a couple of blocks away from where they hid out, their Alamo. You could see the bullet holes in the cement. And that worked on me over time. And so I kind of had to dig them out, bring them back.
So here we have a young boy who is in part Mark Skoka, because we're told in the dedication that his parents lived half of the story. But he is also a child of Czech-American parents who is telling the story the way any child would, of what he remembers of summer vacations, of the family moving to a lake, to bungalows around the lake. Some of the bungalows are themselves stories we've encountered before in Mark Skoka's work. There's a story called The Exile, that a version of which recurs here. But this time, something unusual happens to the storytelling. The boy is thinking of how many stories whose endings he doesn't know.
Yeah, well, it's always about stories whose endings you don't know. And I think it's partly because I grew up with stories that were fragments. I mean, my father and mother were both terrific storytellers, so they could also tell a complete one. But the real stories, the ones that really interested me, were the ones that were never told, where I would be listening to adults having a conversation, and suddenly they'd bump into something invisible, and the conversation would take a detour around this thing. And that's what I was most interested in. The story of my mother's love, and she did have a lifelong love, was one of those stories. I knew about this. It was there. I didn't resent my mother. I think it's very difficult to resent someone for loving. I was very close to my father, and I think the father in this novel is perhaps the hero, really, the one who manages to live his life, the life he's been dealt with something like grace. But that story was always there. I grew up in the shadow of that story, just as I grew up in the shadow of the old world and of history and of the war. But these were all stories that weren't told. So I had to cobble them together. I had to complete the puzzle somehow.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mark Skoka, author most recently of The Visible World, published by Houghton Mifflin. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mark Skoka about his novel, The Visible World. Because so much of the book will gather around the increasing resonance of certain details, I thought I'd ask you to read its first paragraph, which I want to tell readers is also its last paragraph, and it will mean something much richer when you've come to it the second time.
Yeah, it's the whole book really is circular in that sense. That's right. This is the first paragraph. One night when I was young, my mother walked out of the country bungalow we were staying in the Poconos. I woke to hear my father pulling on his pants in the dark. It was very late, and the windows were open. The night was everywhere. Where was he going, I asked. Go back to sleep, he said. Mommy had gone for a walk. He would be right back, he said. But I started to cry because Mommy had never gone for a walk in the forest at night before, and I had never woken to find my father pulling on his pants in the dark. I did not know this place, and the big windows of moonlight on the floor frightened me. In the end, he told me to be brave and that he would be back before I knew it, and pulled on his shoes and went searching for his wife, and found her, eventually, sitting against a tree or by the side of a pond in her tight-around-the-calf slacks and frayed tennis shoes, 15 years too late.
That particular detail of waking at night to find one's parents gone or missing, waking in the midst of a unspoken catastrophe, is a universal, it seems to me, of childhood.
I think so.
I remember the shock of not quite understanding that my mother was being taken to the hospital to give birth to my sister. Right. Where is she? Where is she gone?
Right.
That night remembering is as intense as primal scenes are said to be in Freud, the missing parent rather than the presence of the parent on the other side of the door, seems to me to be very rich. But we're going to read a whole book to find out what that one phrase, that he found her 15 years too late, find out what that means. And that requires a certain faith in the power of language.
Of language and of storytelling, I think. I suppose I'm old-fashioned in the sense that I still believe that a well-told story, it's not for me to say whether this is one of them, but I think a well-told story is a wonderful thing. And and the directions it takes, the curves and the turns, the digressions it takes, if they are controlled, and I think writing that matters for me is very much a kind of a controlled recklessness, maybe something like that. If a story is well told, it will arrive at a kind of a pivot point of understanding. Things have been going in a certain direction, and they turn, and provide just enough illumination, just enough light that something hopefully is understood. Again, those are the stories that move me. I'm not interested in indeterminacy. I'm interested in complexity, and those are two different things.
And what happens, therefore, is that we hear stories again and again. The first time the young man is told that his mother once lost a dog, he's told by his father that the brave girl walked to the gypsy camp and demanded the dog and was given it back. But then years later, other checks, remembering the mother who grew up in that town, said, yes, the gypsies gave the dog back, the corpse of the dog in a sack. And the narrator says, oh, yes, they told me that, but the old neighbors are kind of wise and said, perhaps they wouldn't have told that story to a child.
Right.
And so we get another sense that there are stories we don't know the ends of or the real ends of because someone was being respectful and discreet.
Or kind. Yeah. The first line of that chapter about the dog, the different dog stories, is this is how things were in my house. And then the three stories proceed, and each one of them complicates the one before. I mean, that is how things were in my house, and you're right. I mean, stories are very much told to, to reconcile ourselves to the life we've inherited, but they're also told to be kind, to protect us or others from certain truths that we've decided are not, that we're not ready for perhaps, or they're not ready for. And I think especially when it comes to children, I mean, I grew up with stories, with fairy tales. Some of them were quite ghastly. Those Eastern European fairy tales can be, neck deep in blood. But, as a child, you absorb all kinds of things. And the ones that I was most interested in and that I'm still most interested in are the ones that have a kind of an agenda. They're protecting, they're extending, they're deferring, they're avoiding. They have some sort of a silence at the core. And I think that's what, literature in many ways is precisely that. It goes where the silences are. If everything's been answered, there's nothing to write or read.
Well, it's not just that if everything's been answered. It's the sense the book gives that everything is never answered.
It's never. Well, yeah.
And in fact, even the simplest things here, the father, dressing to go look for his wife, says to the boy, "Be brave." Now, the question this book asks is, what does it mean to be brave? Is being brave staying at home and going back to sleep, or going after the father? Bravery, the mother has been in love with a brave hero who, it turns out, has inadvertently betrayed his fellows, or fears that he will be thought to have done so. Whereas the father, ostensibly not brave, has been the creator of a home and a context for both his wife and his child and his neighbors, a place that they'll come, a place even where people who have been collaborationists have come to play the violin.
Right, right.
And so, you know, he is the founder of what's called in the memoir the New World.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the most courageous character really in this book for me is the father. Not that his rival, the lover of the mother figure here, wasn't brave. I think he was enormously brave. But there are different kinds of bravery, as you said. And it's one thing to be 23 and to do this sort of unspeakably brave thing, which requires physical courage and a certain amount of something that's hard for me to define. It's another thing to sort of endure the life you've been given, that you've inherited, with a certain amount of grace and a certain amount of humor and a certain amount of decency, which is why early on in the story, when the lover is still alive and the father realizes that this is his rival, when he sort of prays, "Please God, you know, let him live, because if he dies, I've lost." What he wants is for his rival to live on and to someday, 20 years later, 5 years later, be arguing over the price of the new furniture or, you know, whatever, and to let time do its work. He said, let him die on the field of days like other men, you know, but don't let him die a romantic death, an early death, because then I have no chance. That's what happens, and the father needs to pick up the pieces. And I think that kind of grace is something that I find hugely appealing, and I think that is where courage really resides. You know, you've been dealt certain cards, play them well. That's different from resignation. Resignation is a different thing. It's recognizing what you've been given and then playing it with a certain style.
Well, at a certain point, there was an image that came to me from your work. Someone is presented with a head in an aquarium, a severed head. It's meant to terrify the recipient.
Yeah.
But I suddenly thought, the head in this underwater world,
that's interesting,
is like
the
underwater people.
Yeah.
And what do you look at when history and a country have gone underwater? There are the schools of fish and the kelp.
Right.
There are the shadows from above. There are the things waving around on the floor below. And the book is very much about trying to relativize all of the possible things you might notice from the past, from the present, and to recognize, yes, that if you submerge yourself like this, you will be underwater and you will drown. That the book asks you to ask the question, how do you put your past in perspective but stay alive and to live? The mother will kill herself.
Right.
And the boy is being asked to perform the heroic feat of writing a book instead of killing himself and staying alive.
Yeah. Well, how we live with our past, I mean, I think that's the question sort of embedded in what you're asking for me anyway. How you live with your past, whether you remain sort of fixed in that moment of sort of peak intensity as the mother does. And I think there are people who simply latch on to a moment, to a face, to a voice, and simply can't abandon it. And I'd be the last to sort of criticize them for that. That's simply who they are. That said, I think for most of us, we need to come to terms with the past, which is continually shaping us. And I believe that we are, every moment of the day, of our waking day, we're being shaped by the past. But I also think, and this is where it gets interesting for me, that we are shaping the past that shapes us, at least in part through the stories that we tell. So we're telling stories about what we did, who we were, who we knew, who we avoided, whatever. And the telling of those stories about our past creates the thing that shapes us in turn. And that back and forth, that sort of that cyclical thing is where the role of story comes in for me.
So when you've written a book like this, one that in a sense concretizes and summarizes a lot of your own life, where are you then?
Where are you then? I suppose, first of all, I think all writing is a kind of a auto-archaeology, right? We're sort of mining the self in order to write anything, shaping it, twisting it. It's plastic in our hands, but we're mining the self. I suppose we're in both places. I'd like to think that I'm in this moment, you know, talking to you right now in this studio. When I get home, I'll be with my wife, with my kids, with our hound. I'll be in that moment as much as I possibly can be. At the same time, I'm constantly traveling in dreams, in through the things that I read on a daily basis, to the places I've been, to the places I've imagined, to the ones that I'm still capable of imagining. So it's this dance, this continual dance between worlds, between not just the visible and the invisible, but the ones that are unfolding at this moment in the nick of time, and those that have already passed me by.
I've been speaking with Mark Skoka, author most recently of The Visible World, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you, Mark, for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can read an excerpt from The Visible World at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books, books, books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.